This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. It's been 40 years since the gruesome murders committed by the Charles Manson family shocked the nation. On August 9, 1969, Manson followers stabbed actress Sharon Tate to death along with four others. Tate, the wife of filmmaker Roman Polanski, was 8.5 months pregnant. The following night, Manson took three of his followers to another house chosen at random, where they murdered Leno and Rosemary LaBianca. Manson, now 74, and four others are still in prison for the murders. Our guest, filmmaker John Waters, says it's time that one of them, Leslie Van Houten, was released. Van Houten was not involved in the Tate murders, but was among the group that killed the LaBiancas. Waters has been visiting Van Houten in prison for 24 years, and he says she's a different person from the brainwashed Manson disciple she was at 19, and that she meets the legal requirements for parole. Waters is writing a book about people who've inspired him called Role Models, and his chapter on Leslie Van Houten is on the website The Huffington Post. He's best known for his tasteless films like Pink Flamingos, Polyester, and Hairspray, which was made into a Broadway show and then a new film based on the show. Waters is also the author of the books Shock Value and Crackpot. Well, John Waters, welcome back to Fresh Air. I think in the interest of accuracy and out of respect for the victims of this crime, we really need to acknowledge the seriousness of what happened here. Remind us what this crime was and what Leslie Van Houten's role was.
Well, yes, I completely agree. Usually when I come on your show, I come on for humor, and there's really nothing funny about this, and there's nothing to parody. It was a tragedy not only for the obvious victims that were murdered, but also, in my mind, for many of the middle-class kids that Manson used and turned into zombies. Leslie Van Houten met Manson when she was 17. She was looking for a spiritual leader like all hippie girls were at that time. That was hardly a radical thing. She joined up with his so-called family that traveled in a school bus, and they were anything but violent. They were hippies, basically, who sang and took LSD. And eventually, Manson was a released convict, and he had been in jail his whole life. He was much older than the girls, and he treated them really like a pimp. They didn't realize that for a long time, and gave them acid and told them what they wanted to hear and isolated them the same way that Jim Jones, the same way every cult leader you've ever had does. It's isolation, it's drugs, it's repeated lack of sleep, it's staying up all night believing in some group thing they're going to survive some apocalyptic thing. Leslie Van Houten did not go the night of the terrible Sharon Tate murder. She is not convicted of that crime, but she went the second night. She is convicted of the LaBianca murders. She went. They went out randomly. Charles Manson went in the house, tied up Mr. LaBianca and Mrs. LaBianca, came outside and told Tex Watson, Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krumwinkel to go inside. Tex Watson killed Mr. LaBianca and stabbed Mrs. LaBianca and then told the girls to, quote, do something. And they stabbed her.
But I just want to be clear about this one thing.
Yeah.
I mean, as I understand it, when Leslie Van Houten went into Rosemary LaBianca's bedroom, she and Patricia Krumwinkel actually grabbed her, put a pillowcase around her.
Yes.
And then when she struggled, my understanding is that Leslie then held her while Patricia Krumwinkel tried to stab her, and then eventually Tex Watson came in and completed the murder. So just whatever her state
yes.
of mind, her actions
her state
were,
of mind.
Were her, yeah. But whatever her state of mind, her actions were those of a fully participating member of this murder
yes.
party, right?
Completely, yeah. And I have never said otherwise. And she has said, and it's in the chapter of my book, she said, every act that happened in that house I take responsibility for. It was me.
Now, of course, they were all captured and tried together at the first trial.
Yes.
What was she like at the first trial?
In the first trial, she was the Manson. The three of the girls were laughed their way, said sorry is a five-letter word that can't bring anybody back. They were under complete Manson's orders. They carved X's in their forehead. They did every bit of completely insane behavior.
They were unrepentant. Did
yes.
they have shaved heads?
Yeah. I think during the penalty phase, they shaved their head after he did. Whatever he did, they did. And they were sentenced to the death penalty. Then what happened was Leslie's attorney was found dead in the middle of the trial. I do not believe the Manson family killed him. There is not the slightest bit of evidence ever that there was. But tabloids bring that up all the time. And he had never tried a major case in his life, really. He was pretty much of an amateur. And so she got another lawyer who was pretty good, but she had an appeal for ineffective counsel, and she got a new trial. She was then away from Manson. She began to break down and realize this terrible thing that had happened. The brainwashing started to come off. She started to realize that what she thought was this insane war, that the Beatles talking to them, they were going to live in the desert. I mean, complete insanity that any other person could never imagine really being true. She started to break down and realize that the real terror and the horror of what she had done.
So years passed. I mean, the crimes were in 1969. She got her new.
Yes.
She was granted a new trial in 1976, and it was held the following year. Tell us what
yes.
she was like then.
Well, it took some time. I mean, they built them a special death row, the three girls, and I give really credit to the women that worked in the prison because they sort of finally got Leslie to believe where is it? It didn't happen. I mean, you know, and they started to, as Leslie told me, her mind started to break down like a machine breaking down, that she would start spouting this gibberish, and then she would realize, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. And it was the first time she ever realized that she had been scammed, really, that this whole thing she was believing in was completely fictitious. By the time she had her second trial, she was away from all them. She was by herself. She had a very good lawyer. And it was a hung jury. It was 7 for guilty of first-degree murder and 5 for guilty of manslaughter because of diminished capacity. She was let out on bail. She had a job. She lived peacefully in Los Angeles. When the neighbors found out who she was, they were protected. They were not horrified. And she went back, and then they added a new charge because some coins were taken from the LaBianca house of robbery. And when there is a robbery, you cannot really bring in diminished capacity. So she was charged. They couldn't use that defense on the third trial. And she was found guilty and sentenced to life, not life without parole.
All right. So she was convicted of murder, conspiracy, and robbery. In that trial, did she take the stand and tell her story?
Oh, yes. She took the stand at both. But truthfully for the first time, because in the first trial, she made up all these ridiculous stories. All the girls took the blame, so Manson he thought he would get off. But no, for the first, she told the truth in both the second and the third trial.
And how did she explain what happened?
Well, you know, she's been trying to explain it to herself and to the world for 40 years. It's a tough thing. But she believed in the beginning that he was some magic man. She fell hook, line, and sinker for it. Whatever he did to them, he knew how to do it well. He was a great con man. He was a pimp. And he got those girls. He turned them out. They were for him. He got them under his control. He got them. He's the perfect kind of thing where he gave them more LSD than he took. And it wasn't really that much of a sexual thing. It wasn't like they all slept with him all the time. It was just this kind of group madness that people, these were young runaway kids, hippie kids in a radical time in the 60s when everybody was talking about the revolution coming. You know, Abby Hoffman, the revolution for the hell of it, all that stuff. It wasn't so far-fetched to believe in these kind of revolutions. So she fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. And as she said at one point, it was too late. Once the violence happened, they were so far gone, they didn't even know, really. She said that they were living in the desert, like building roads to bottomless pits. And they were completely out of their mind, if you want my opinion. But yet she doesn't let herself off that easy. She said, I let him be a leader. I am responsible for making him this cult figure. I was part of it. So I think part of ever having a real sorrow and real guilt and really being rehabilitated is to admit that you really did do something. And she doesn't just blame it on everybody else. I actually think that it is more, you know, that it was Manson's fault, but it's too easy to say that.
So after the third trial, she goes back into prison and she has served now nearly 40 years. What has she done with her time behind bars?
Well, she's gotten every degree she's gotten. She's gotten every job you could ever have in the prison. You're only allowed to work for 2 years in one particular job. She's done the AIDS quilt. She's taught many, many women to read. She, for one thing, she has survived in a very violent atmosphere with not one charge ever of violence ever. Before that night, there was never violence in her life, and there has never been violence in her life since that terrible night.
And she has been coming up for parole board hearings and has been rejected every time. Now,
yes.
You raise the issue in your piece of what is fair. And, of course, there is no sentence that she could serve nor fine she could pay that equals two human lives. But, you know, legal systems have to confront this all the time. And there are guidelines for sentencing and parole which take into account a number of factors, such as, you know, the seriousness of the offense, the need to deter others, the extent to which an inmate has rehabilitated herself.
Can I say that the last two things she's done, the first one she can never change. She can never take away the crime.
Have you or Leslie ever communicated with any of the members of the LaBianca family?
Well, Leslie is in the court, in the parole hearing with them. And she, you know, it's very hard to apologize in there because the rules that they never announce and that you don't know about is you aren't allowed to look at the relatives. She is not allowed to even look at them when she talks about them. So she has always wanted to apologize through the prison system where they set up a meeting, and that has not happened. She has certainly apologized in the parole hearings, but I don't think to the depth that she would like to do, but she would like, hopefully like to do that in private.
You know, we said earlier, and you agreed, that there's no prison sentence anyone could serve which could equal the loss of two lives. But she has served nearly 40 years. How does that compare to, you know, the sentences that other murderers have served?
Well, let's put it this way. She's been in jail longer than any other woman in California. And when they turned – in her first trial, when they turned over, they made the death penalty illegal and everybody automatically got life. There was two other women on death row that had done really hideous cases. And they served 7 to 8 years and were released to absolutely no public outcry.
How did you get to know Leslie Van Houten?
Well, I was in the very beginning very drawn to the case. I went to the original trial. I've been a journalist for a long time. I wanted to write about it, and I was more interested. I never wanted to interview Manson. Rolling Stone had asked me to interview him, and I thought, I'm not interested in him. It's just like somebody you'd move away from in a bar. She says now a pathetic, disgusting old man. But I was interested in a few of the followers who seemed very much like the kids I knew from my neighborhood that went pretty wild too. So I wrote to her, and she said that she did not want to be in Rolling Stone. She later told me she's never signed an autograph. She finds it incredibly painful, and I've seen that in the visiting room when people come over and say, "Could I have your autograph?" And I can see the pain in her face when people ask that. And there was a group called Friends of Leslie at the time that was all her support group, pretty much a lot of women that had worked in the prison and her family and her family's friends and everything. And she said, you know, I would write to you, but if you're in a hurry to be friends, it's never going to work. And then I realized, well, I'm not going to write about her. And so I wrote her, and then gradually we did become friends. And I never wrote about it for 20-some years until I wrote this book. And this book is about people that have inspired me for very, very different reasons, from Tennessee Williams to Leslie Van Houten, because of her patience and because I'm always incredibly interested in if you do something really terrible once, can you ever, ever get beyond that? So we gradually did become friends, and I didn't go to visit her as a journalist.
Could you talk a little bit about the first time you met?
Trying to remember. I mean, it's been in the same visiting room for many years now. We went, and I remember the woman that was in the Friends of Leslie that sort of set it up. And she may have had another visitor that day that was a man that is no longer alive, but he was a high-up editor of the L.A. Times that was friends of her family's. And he was there for moral support to her also. She was guarded with me. She should have been. But we talked. I don't remember the exact first time, but I do remember we had written for a couple of years before I actually went, I believe. So we certainly knew enough about each other at the time. And she wrote me in there that she trusted me and that for once I made her not feel like a freak and she needed that. So I never asked her about the crime. I didn't bring that up. That's really bad jail manners. And that took many, many years for her to ever discuss at all with me.
Why did you persist so in this relationship, do you think? I mean, write her so many times before you met and then continued to see her?
Because I liked her in the mail. I liked her. You know, I have very varied friends that have done a lot of different things. I guess I went in it as a journalist and liked the subject probably too much then at that time to have written about it with much insight. And then we became friends, and I stopped thinking about it that way. I didn't keep notes all these years. I did keep every clipping, all the parole hearings and everything, so I had 25, 30 years of research to go through when I wrote this piece. But it wasn't so much about what she did. That wasn't what we talked about. We talked about what she could do while she was in there. She liked to read books. We talked about books. I sent her books. That's the one thing I did send her. She tried writing. She went to school. She talked about what she was doing in school. She talked about the program she was involved in. She talked. It was kind of like having a relative that you visit that's in a hospital or something. It seemed more that was our relationship. And she grew to know my friends. She used to ask about people. When Divine died, she wrote me a really very, very lovely letter. She was good. I mean, we advised each other about personal relationships. We just became friends, like everybody's friends.
I wonder if you – I imagine that you may have talked to Leslie about whether it would be helpful to her to have somebody like you who obviously has, you know, a kind of a history of making things that some have considered offensive and outrageous and certainly – you know, kind of countercultural years back. Did you consider about whether you were the right person to be making her public case?
Very much. And I asked her that, and I say in the book, are they going to take any sentences or any parts out of context about this, you know, 14,000 words I wrote and use it against her again? And I brought that up to her. And I said, before I print this, I want you to know that, you know, that could happen. And she said, well, you know, I only thing I can base my maturity on is friendship, and you have been a friend to me. You could help me get a job when you get out. You taught in prison. You have a successful career. You've made 16 movies. You've written 3 books. You have art shows. You are an upstanding member of society, whether they like it or not, and anymore. So yes, she trusted me to do it. She's not ready yet.
You make a confession in this piece that you've written about Leslie Van Houten that earlier in your filmmaking career, you used the Manson killings in what you described as a jokey, smart-ass way in some films.
Yes, I did.
How did you do that?
Well, I'll tell you this, that when I made movies like Multiple Maniacs and Pink Flamingos, they were made for a hippie audience to scare hippies. The Manson family did that only in real life. We did it for humor. They shockingly did it for real. I think the big difference was at the time that there was no such thing as punk rock. It was coming. But, you know, when those girls shaved their head and put wasn't it punk rock? They didn't know that. I later asked Leslie, did you ever feel cool? And she looked at me so blankly and said, we were so far gone, we didn't even know what that word meant. I mean, no, they never felt cool. But in a weird way, before punk and everything, I guess I fell for that, for the shock value of them, for the fact of that they scared the world. And in a way, I was trying to do that with humor, which is very, very different. I had the outlet for every unsocial, radical, angry act I could have. I just made a movie about it. I never did it. But at the time, there was Abbie Hoffman saying, revolution for the hell of it. Kill your parents. I mean, but it was done. We knew he didn't mean that. It was revolution. It was play revolution.
Right. I mean, but a couple of films you dedicated to Manson, members of the Manson family,
well,
right?
Yeah. Pink Flamingos, which was basically about the filthiest people alive. And they were.
And I read that you've dedicated the film Female Trouble to Tex Watson, who was really one of the, you know.
Well, yeah, and that was really irresponsible. And I admit that. This chapter is as much as how I've changed, you know, through this. Charles Watson is basically who killed every one of the victims. He was Manson's best piece of work ever. But I'm not here to stick up for any of them but for Leslie. I'm not sure that all of them didn't have the same thing happen to them. They were controlled by a madman.
Why do you think you were so fascinated with the Manson case and a lot of other cases where it seems that you do have a real interest in crime?
Well, I always said if I wasn't a filmmaker, I'd be a lawyer. And this week I sort of feel like one because I've been sticking up for her. I'm interested in behavior I can't understand, in extreme behavior and how people can survive that. I've always been interested in things there's no fair answer, that I don't know the answer. If I knew the answer, I wouldn't be interested in it anymore. Psychological issues have always been fascinating to me.
Do you think you could have ever been brainwashed and misled the way they were?
No, I don't think I could have because I was our gang's leader and my people that said no to me. I asked Ming Stoll to set her hair on fire once. She said, are you crazy? I asked Cookie Muller to smash in a television while I was on. She said no. So And I didn't even think then that that was a weird thing to ask. So in our group madness, whatever you call it, that was for film, no. Everybody said no to me, and I was the bad influence. I was the leader. And so I was never looking for someone to tell me what to do. All directors tell other people what to do. And but I think my group was pretty healthy because we were doing stuff for humor and making movies. But when I went too far, they said no.
So you had a will of your own. You weren't looking for a messiah.
I was not looking for a messiah. But that doesn't mean that people that are wrong.
Okay.
I was not, no. We sort of made fun of hippies that did that, if you want to know the truth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with filmmaker John Waters, who's written a chapter in his forthcoming book, Role Models, about Leslie Van Houten, a former member of the Charles Manson family who served nearly 40 years in prison for the murder of a California couple in 1969. Waters argues that Van Houten has been a model inmate who's taken responsibility for her crime and meets the legal standard for parole. You can read his chapter on the Huffington Post. Waters attended the Manson trial and has a long-standing interest in people who commit crimes and how they rebuild their lives. You taught in prison, didn't you?
Yes, I did, in the 80s, yep.
Yeah. Tell us what made you do that.
Well, as I said, if I wasn't a filmmaker, I'd be a lawyer. My friend taught in there, and he asked me if I'd like to come in and be a guest teacher for the day. So I did. I showed all my movies in there. It was a very special institute called Patuxent. It was run by Norma Gluckstern, a warden that was pretty avant-garde at the time. 60 Minutes did a thing on it. And it was mostly people that had done only one terrible crime. They didn't have a history, and it had a lot of psychological treatment. It wasn't for people that pled insanity, but it was for people that maybe should have. I taught filmmaking in there. We had I made them do improv and play the opposite of themselves. My classes were good, and I learned as much as they did, I think, by teaching in there about the human condition. I did learn that they look like any class in any junior college anywhere. And their parents probably were very, very conservative about what they thought should happen to criminals before it hit their family. And they were just as shocked. I mean, the Leslie Van Houten's mother and dad, they were so horrified about what happened, but they stuck by her. And they said that when she was in jail, when they finally got her, they would much rather have her in jail than not know where she was, which it was like before. So I saw it's always unfair. It's never going to be fair, but I saw both sides of it. I saw the victims whose families, of course, are torn apart by it and want the worst, and the families who their kids have gone wrong. You know, nobody's parents thinks their kids are going to do these kind of things. But it does happen. And then they have to deal with it. And sometimes it can be very touching how they do try their very best to deal with it when they realize maybe they screwed up the first time. Mm-hmm. Although Leslie has said at every parole hearing, my parents had nothing to do with this. They didn't do anything wrong that caused any of this. None of this is their fault.
You said that you got to know both sides of the crime, those who commit crimes and the victims. When and how did you get to know victims?
Well, certainly in the courtrooms I went to, and I had different students and everything, and I would see the victims testify. And it's incredibly moving. And to be honest, the ones that are badly spoken are better at it even, because it's you realize how uncomfortable they are to be there and how terrible this is for them. And they're never going to get over it. And yet, what do you do? The other person is alive. I'm an optimist. I believe in life. I believe that some people can change. Believe me, I think there's plenty of people that should never get out of jail. There's serial killers, people that have done the same thing over and over, child molesters. I'm talking about Leslie is a special case.
You know, media coverage in films can certainly have an impact on how cases proceed, and it's certainly impacted Leslie Van Houten and every other member of, everyone involved in the Manson case. I mean, the film Helter Skelter was made many years ago. And then in 2003...
There's a couple of them, yeah.
Right. And then in 2003, when CBS was considering remaking it, you called the director, John Gray, right, and told him what?
I did. They did remake it. And he took my call. I don't know. He probably thought I was calling to say, oh, I don't know. But I said, please, you know, this is just going to so hurt Leslie Van Houten. It's going to hurt the chance. It's going to hurt the victims. It's just to do this again. And he listened, and I never talked to him again, but her part wasn't that big. And then I was eating in a restaurant in L.A., and I was meeting my agent, and I was early, and the waitress said to me, can I ask you something? Are you in the Friends of Leslie organization? I said, well, there's not – that's been disbanded. There's no such thing, but I am with a group of people that support her release. And she said, because I played her in the movie. And I said, oh, God, you know, only in Hollywood. And I said, well, you know, I called the director, and I probably made your part smaller. And she said, you did. It did get cut. And I just want to tell you that I believe you were right, too, that I tried to play her, and I think she should get out, too. And I thought, wow, that was such a strange experience. Only in Los Angeles could something like that happen. But it's just another – every time they redo it, every time it's just more it, – and nobody thought this would happen. It's become a Halloween costume.
You know, you have this career as a filmmaker, and it's sort of you know, your films are sort of so transgressive and outrageous. I mean, you're kind of were a cultural outlaw, but over time have really achieved some mainstream success. And I'm wondering, do you think that's why maybe you identify with criminals who have rebuilt their lives and rehabilitated themselves? Is there a parallel?
Yeah, I think it most definitely is, although I didn't have to rehabilitate everything because my crimes were done for art.
Right.
They were done for humor, which certainly I'm not saying this was. But at the same time, sure, I've always identified with outsiders, people outside the law, outlaws. Yeah, I'm interested in people that have had extreme lives. And I'm really fascinated by people that had a bad past that have overcome it. And that, to me, is very, very important to me.
Well, John Waters, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
John Waters' book, Role Models, will be published next year. His chapter on Leslie Van Houten appeared on The Huffington Post. The new film, Adam, is a romantic comedy about a young couple in their 20s who meet when the woman, Beth, moves into Adam's building in New York. Pretty standard fare, right? It might be, except that the title character, Adam, has Asperger's syndrome, a high-functioning variant of autism. People with Asperger's are often exceptionally intelligent and verbally gifted, but socially awkward, since they have trouble reading emotional cues from others. Many with Asperger's have a special interest which can become an obsession. In the film, Adam's special interests are astronomy and theater history. My guest is the writer and director of Adam, Max Mayer. Mayer has spent most of his career directing theater and has written 3 produced plays. His only other feature film, Better Living, starred Roy Scheider and Olympia Dukakis. Adam stars Hugh Dancy, and Beth is played by Rose Byrne. In this scene from the film, Adam is meeting Beth's parents for the first time at a theater in New York. Her parents are played by Peter Gallagher and Amy Irving.
We rarely go off Broadway. I didn't even know this theater still existed.
The Cherry Lane Theater is the oldest continuously running theater off Broadway. It was converted from a box factory in 1924, and then in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it presented the work of writers such as F. Scott Fitzgerald, John Dos Passos, Eugene O'Neill.
I used to bone up on conversation topics, too, when I had a date.
That's back in 1951 to 1953, Julian Beck and Judith Malina's Living Theater was based here. In 1952, Judith Malina chased a fire marshal down the street with a spear from her production of Oubliois. Endgame by Samuel Beckett had its American premiere here in 1957, followed by other new works such as Happy Days, also by Beckett in 1962, Dutchman in 1964 by Leroy Jones, The Happy Journey to Trenton and Camden by Thornton Wilder in 1960. But that's enough about the Cherry Lane Theater.
What about the 70s?
Well, in 1971, Godspell opened.
Adam, and Daddy's joking.
Oh.
I asked Max Mayer how he imagined the mental state of someone with Asperger's to write the dialogue for Adam.
It's almost a question of bandwidth in a way. I mean, I've heard people with Asperger's describe it like that there's a... there's a sort of narrower bandwidth of stimulus that they receive in the sense that many of them are very literal in terms of and rely on the word that the other person is speaking, for instance, that rather than reading in terms of tone or inflection. I think, you know, in choosing Hugh Dancy, and also what I had said to him originally was that I don't want an introverted person to play this part, basically. I think that Adam is basically an extroverted person who has gotten a bit beaten down through experience of being inappropriate or finding out that what he's said is inappropriate or how he's behaved and that sort of thing, but is fundamentally a sort of trusting and gregarious person who is trying to connect in a very real way to other people, but doesn't understand why one would look into somebody else's eyes to get information, because he doesn't get any information that way. In fact, a lot of people with Asperger's say it's sort of it feels bad to them to look in someone else's eyes. We did a Q&A a few days ago after a screening, which one of the people in the audience had Asperger's, and somebody mentioned something about the eye contact thing, and he just said, "Well, I look at mouths because that's where the sound comes from." And people kind of laugh, there's a certain unassailable logic to life in that way.
In the beginning of the movie, we don't, Adam's diagnosis hasn't been articulated. We don't know what it is. And I wonder, could you share with us some of the visual details that you use to convey, his life and his world?
Well, the movie starts out after his father's just died. So there's a scene with him at a funeral in which he has a somewhat odd or slightly seemingly vacant reaction to this funeral, and you find out a little bit later when he comes home, because he has there's a chart up on the refrigerator about for chores, and there's Adam's chores and Dad's chores, and he takes the pen and he crosses out Dad, from Dad's chores, and realizes that now he's going to have to do more of the chores. And that could be taken as sort of heartless in a way, but it's, as I've come to understand it, it's a much more sort of present tense sense of the world that many people with Asperger's have of rather than sort of dwelling on a feeling or on something that's happened in the past. It's actually, the kind of the next thing, feel the sort of feeling realm is a very sort of awkward realm, so it's better to get on with it.
I mean, the heart of the story is his relationship with this woman, Beth, who is played by Rose Byrne. They meet because she happens to move into another apartment in his building, and he is struck by her. And when you were crafting this story, I'm wondering how you decided upon what kind of woman would be drawn to Adam. How did you decide what kind of character to write for Beth?
Well, I think that some of her outstanding characteristics are she's very curious. She has a really good sense of humor, which from what I understand is a sort of absolute must for people who are having relationships with people with Asperger's syndrome. She's also is sort of in a crisis in the sense that the way she's been brought up and the sort of idealized view that she's had of her family is in the process of crumbling, and she is in the process of realizing that things that she took for granted or believed about her family and her family's relationships weren't true. So I think she's in a space where honesty and fidelity are especially salient to her at the moment. So I think some of the things that Adam offers in terms of honesty and intelligence and the fact that he can be counted on are very attractive.
There's a moment in early in the relationship where Adam reveals to Beth that he has this issue, this syndrome, Asperger's. And I'm sure that's something that you thought about when you were crafting the scripts. And it comes fairly early in the film, so we're not giving away much. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you decided he would reveal this to Beth.
Right. First of all, it does come a little later than I think you would ordinarily think to discover it in a film. I mean, I think it's about a third of the way through or whatever. And it was important to me that the audience kind of get to know Adam without necessarily putting a label on him. Of course, that's just for the first weekend of the movie, because now everybody who's going to it pretty much knows what it's about. But in terms of the experience of the film itself, he's not labeled for, the first half hour or whatever. And that was kind of important to me, in that I did want people to be intrigued and sort of leaning forward and trying to figure it out, and then and get to know him a little bit as a person before you put a label on it, because the label tends to just become that. The person then becomes a label if you sort of learn about it too soon. And that's actually an issue in the Asperger's community too, about when to divulge your diagnosis to neurotypicals. But the other thing I wanted was for it to be truthful, in the sense that I think Adam would not, the character I know wouldn't divulge it until he needed to. And so I basically waited until Beth was almost out the door at a certain point, and so that he kind of had to tell her that to keep her in the room.
And what he had done was to say something kind of inappropriate at that point in their relationship about the fact that he was sexually attracted to her, and it put her off. And so he jumps in and says, wait a minute. There's a reason I said something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to play a clip from the film, and this is a point at the film in which it's right after Adam and Beth, the woman that he's in the relationship with, have had a fight. And Beth shows up and sort of as a peace gesture has brought him a box of chocolates.
I'm sorry. Some chocolate.
I'm not Forrest Gump, you know.
Of course not. I didn't eat... Was that a joke? Are you joking?
I can't joke.
I'm sorry. I took it out on you. I'm just scared for my father. You can apologize too, you know.
Well, you said it was your fault.
And that's Hugh Dancy and Rose Byrne from the new film Adam, which is written and directed by our guest, Max Mayer. You know, you can hear in that scene that he's taking things so literally. He can't understand why he would apologize also, because she just declared that it was her fault. But the scene begins with him cracking that joke, and it kind of threw me because, you know, I was used to thinking of him as someone who is so literal, does not pick up subtext and inference in conversation. And yet there's this wonderful little ironic joke that he pulls out of, you know, out of the cinema and this gesture. Is this typical of folks with Asperger's? I wonder... Is that
well? I think that that we supply a bunch of the irony. Actually, I think that from Adam's standpoint, I mean, he is reminding Beth gently that he's not retarded. You know,
right.
I mean that he doesn't have a cognitive impairment. You know, and he knows that he's you know, not, you know, coming down hard on her or anything, but he has a literal purpose, I think.
So he's not making a joke then, or is he?
yes, I think he's, he's, you know, he's tentatively hoping and that it's funny, that, you know, that she will both, that she'll get the message, and that he's doing it in a way that's light. But this is very far on in their relationship. And I think that in a way he's taking a big chance, because, you know, which he would never do with somebody he didn't know that well.
You know, the other interesting thing, I mean, you were saying that in some respects the difficulties with Asperger's are sort of a metaphor for the difficulties of people in relationships. You know, we all want to connect and communicate, but it's hard and we struggle with it. The other thing that struck me here was the fact that Adam, you know, he just has no filters. I mean, he's tactlessly honest. He has no interest, for example, in her friend's baby pictures, and therefore kind of insults them. And
right.
It struck me that a lot of women who think that their guys are kind of tactless and insensitive and clueless probably look at this and looking at this thinking, gosh, I wonder if my boyfriend has Asperger's.
Yes, it's kind of wonderful how you hear sort of higher pitched laughs in the audience and lower pitched laughs in the audience, and they sort of and they kind of take turns In that clip that you showed, I think that a lot of men would identify with Adam saying, "Well, you said it was your fault. Why would I apologize?" That kind of makes sense to me as a man, and that's probably something I have to work on in my life. But by the same token, the reverse is true, where he says things that are obviously to neurotypicals inappropriate but honest, and comes out as a bull in a china shop, or certainly provides more information than anybody wants fairly often.
You know, I wonder if, as this film, you know, gets attention, I mean, do you feel the presence of advocates for Asperger's out there, ready to either pounce on something in the film that you got wrong, or make you a champion for their cause? I mean, there are issues. I mean, there are public policy issues, like the difficulty of people with, you know, Asperger's getting needed services because they're not regarded as sufficiently mentally handicapped. I mean, are you ready to become an advocate?
What is a disability and all that?
Right.
I very much feel that. I didn't up until the last 3 weeks. We've been going sort of around the country on a bit of a junket and showing the movie all over the country. And some of those screenings have had large numbers of people with Asperger's. And at the beginning, certainly, my heart was always sort of in my mouth as soon as somebody stood up and said, "Well, I have Asperger's," partly because, you know, they have a right to criticize and they have the right to say this is accurate or representative or not or whatever. Partly for that, and also because you know that you're going to get the straight dope, basically, because there isn't the same kind of filter or you know, they're not really invested in being charitable or assuaging my insecurities or whatever. But fortunately, I must say the reaction has been unbelievably gratifying. People have seemed to be almost humblingly grateful that this movie is out, and they feel like it is an accurate representation, not of the entire community, because that's, you know, not possible, but that it's an accurate representation of someone with Asperger's, of a unique human being with Asperger's, and also a positive representation. So that's been incredibly gratifying, and also a little bit, sometimes I feel a little bit like a fraud, because, as I said, that's not why I made the movie. I made the movie sort of to talk about relationships and my own and other people's and used Asperger's, wanting to be accurate about it. But if it has the byproduct of making the our neurotypical world a little bit more interested and compassionate and and valuing of that community, that's a great thing.
So when you had these screenings and people with Asperger's rose and said things, what kind of things did you hear?
Well, there was one young woman who basically started a list of things that she liked about the movie, starting with the crane shot that started on the leaf and pulled focus to the van. So she was being, you know, very precise, and then, you know, went on with a list of maybe 10 or 12 more things that she really liked, both sort of large and small, and that was kind of impressive. Then there are... the most sort of touching thing about those Q&As, I think, have to do with parents of children who have Asperger's, because I think the movie touches both on their fears and their hopes for their children's future and their concern for sort of what happens when they're left on their own. So some people are extremely emotional about the film and feel like that the film does give them a certain hope about their children and moving on and forming other attachments in life, which is a realistic hope and not sort of just rosy and Hollywoodized or whatever. And then there are people with Asperger's who just are just sort of frankly state that they think that it was well done and they understand they recognize themselves in the movie. And there's you can hear a lot of sort of laughter of recognition from those audiences.
Well, Max Meyer, we'll be waiting to see what you come up with next. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, it was a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Max Meyer wrote and directed the new film, Adam. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhevar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. Mike Seeger, the singer, multi-instrumentalist, and folklorist, died Friday at the age of 75. The cause was blood cancer. Seeger, with his band the New Lost City Ramblers, was a major figure in the folk revival of the 50s and 60s. He was also the half-brother of Pete Seeger. We'll close with Mike Seeger playing and singing on his 2007 CD, Early Southern Guitar Styles. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.